I'm a bit hesitant, but I'm going to open it up for questions. I've been hearing the questions coming in from the audience, and I keep feeling relieved that I'm not having to answer these questions because I'm not so scholarly and I'm not a wizard like Ajahn Amaro is, but we can have a bit of fun maybe and see what comes of it. And I might actually opt out if it's something I feel is a good question. We'll flag it and we'll present it to Ajahn Amaro later.
Good morning, Venerable. I wanted to ask about non-formal practice. So if you could give some concrete examples of how out in just your typical day working, you might practice. I find my practice becomes a lot less intuitive and it becomes a lot more intellectual. So I was wondering if yours sort of does the same. Or...
I'd say that my practice is far from intellectual, so this is almost an easy one for me to answer. And you've visited our monastery in New Hampshire, and how in our monasteries it isn't so much about just kind of drilling down on, say, a certain technique or certain ideas. We still live our lives looking after whatever duties we have. Say, Ajahn Amaro talking about being on 20 committees and all this and all that. And myself, I'm quite an active kind of work monk, and taking say the practice, the sense of practice or bhavana, just basically opening the concept of it from, it's not just when I'm say sitting or walking, it's all the time. That can take a while or it depends for each individual. For myself, when I really start to understand what these teachers were talking about, like awareness, like this intuitive awareness, like what is consciousness and awareness. And then when you kind of get it, you realize that once you kind of wake up, like you're there, like there's a there-ness. And when practicing, say, formally with just being with that awareness, it seems to, and also I'll note doing a lot of walking meditation also really has helped, say, that transition of formal practice versus daily life practice. That awareness is just with you, wherever you go. So of course, as monastics, we have kind of our kind of training rules and our protocols that, we have these little reminders like, say, keeping your socks pulled up or these sorts of things, or how you act when the senior monk is there, or, the endless lists of kind of protocol that we follow in monasteries. This kind of helps us, too, to kind of stay in the arena of not just being, super distracted, because the system basically catches you for not being mindful. You'll do something wrong, your friends will point it out, or you'll trip over something, or, whatever. On the actual practical, a day in the life, it's just those little micro moments, like you just reach for a piece of wood and, you just feel the wood, and, there you are. And I remember a few years ago, Ajahn Amaro was talking about these 5-second retreats. We often have these grandiose ideas that meditation retreats need to be 10 days and so many hours a day and whatever. But coming into the present moment is actually just as quick as that. Whatever is happening, as soon as we become aware of awareness, we're there, and it's just kind of that easy. And so, just taking a moment, say, you put the kettle on. There's just that 1 second. Where if you just stop, the thoughts can just go away, and then there you are, just standing in the kitchen. Another thing which is helpful is to not get on oneself for, say, being lost in thought or being kind of caught up in an emotion or kind of getting fed up because this guy isn't stacking wood, fast enough or whatever. You can still see that all happening. It's not like we get caught into these emotions and, we're not there. We can just feel them and see them. And then the practice is not kind of feeding into that to cause, say, disharmony within, whoever's around. So again, kind of as I've been talking about the body, these little moments of, say, walking across a field or walking to a door or grabbing a doorknob, you can play these little games. Even Lungpur Smeda talked about making a practice of just being aware when he'd walk through a doorway. Every doorway that he walked through, here I am, and then on you go. And some people, they put little timers on their watches or their little phones or these little reminders. And these are all really, skillful means and kind of clever ways. Ultimately, once you've done it enough, you're just conditioning yourself. You're conditioning the mind. It just becomes more and more regular, and you just find yourself getting less distracted and less kind of swept away by things. And the practice becomes interesting when you get real kind of strong emotions like anger and whatnot coming. But then you kind of just see, you realize that the shelf life of those is actually quite short by just looking at it, like what's actually happening in this moment, letting go of the storyline, coming back to the basics, what am I feeling, what's the body doing? And then once the storyline is kind of like lost a little bit of fuel, it all seems to kind of settle down. You know, to stay angry, you have to keep thinking about that thing that's keeping us angry or lustful. You have to keep thinking about that thing to keep it going. Once we recognize a thought as a thought, it loses its kind of gravitas, and then, you know, it kind of slowly just diminishes. Does that at all help?
Oh, yeah. A lot.
Okay.
And walking meditation, you said it was a great transition.
Yeah. And again, that's another kind of bedrock practice in the Thai circles. You know, every dwelling place in the monasteries has a walking path. So, you know, myself, I'd say the first like 7 years, 8 years, I was doing 80% walking practice. And it's a great practice. But so isn't everything else. You know, like work becomes a practice. Your life is your practice. Wherever you go, like there you are. Like, you know, where you know. Okay. Yeah.
Hello. What is helpful in while we are practicing walking meditation? What should we focus on to make it more helpful for oneself?
Yeah. The basics, or the things that help it kind of, you know, remain easy and uncomplicated, is first of all having two kind of things that you're walking back and forth to, so you don't have to like, oh, how should I take three more steps or one more step? So, you know, often if we have a path, it's quite obvious, but you know, you can use stones or even like your shoes or something, and then you kind of set the parameters of your, say, walking area. Another thing that's, it's helpful to have like some kind of composure, so like bodily composure. So, you know, even, you know, just having your kind of hands kind of, so as we're sitting here, you know, usually we get kind of comfortable, you're kind of bringing that kind of focus into the walking posture. You know, it's not kind of just strolling back and forth and whatever, it's kind of maintain, focus. And then keeping your gaze in front of you. Again, it's very easy to get distracted. You see the paraglider screaming or hear birds or chipmunks or whatever it is, so it's quite easy to kind of like look around. So that's where you have to catch yourself and then come back to like, okay, just keep your gaze, you know, stay 10 feet in front. And just a side note, this doesn't mean that like going for a walk or enjoying nature is like, it's like bad or wrong. It's more like when we're actually using the walking practice as like a technique or a practice. So keeping your attention focused and in front of you, and then finding something, and I'll say that generally the feet has been an obvious one for me, along with using the word Bhutto. In Thailand, we often use this word Bhutto along with, say, the breathing, or in this case, in walking, just to kind of another helpful way to keep the mind on track with what's happening, because you can't really be saying Bhutto and thinking about cooking dinner and the recipes and all this sort of stuff. Keeping the awareness of, say, the bottom of the feet, or for a long time, I used just like my right leg, like just what my right leg was doing, because I found it interesting. And as I was saying earlier, you kind of find kind of playful ways that make it interesting so that you actually do it. Because if you just find it really boring, you'll do it for 10 minutes and that'll be it, and you won't go back to it. But just to get the gist, yeah, you're using, say, the bottoms of your feet, feeling the sensation of the ground as it goes by, and, you know, say Bhutto, or you can even say one, two, or, you know, whatever helps, say, keeps the attention there. One really useful thing is to stop every time we get to the end of the path, actually stop and just take a moment, either before you turn around or, you know, after you've turned around, and just kind of collect yourself. Again, as I was saying, when you're lost in a thought or emotion, just to take that moment to kind of, okay, here I am, awareness, body, okay, and then, you know, then go again. Because you can sometimes watch when you're doing these like meditation workshops, you watch other people doing, sometimes you can just see, and it happens to me too, because like you get like building projects or sewing projects, whatever it is, you start to really kind of get lost in that. You kind of forget where you are, and then you're just pacing. You're like a tiger in a zoo, just kind of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's funny to watch. You can see people do it, and they're literally just off somewhere, and they just go back and forth, back and forth. So to take that moment, you know, at the end of the path, to actually stop, recollect yourself, and then, you know, then start again. One teacher a long time ago also had a little marker too, like in the middle of the path, is like another reminder, which somehow worked. Like even now, I still have this like little bing halfway there, and it, you know, helps bring the attention there. So those are some kind of like basic kind of your posture, your attention, taking moments, kind of sticking to one thing too. Like really, if you're going to do it for half an hour, really try to stick with one thing. We can, maybe I'll pay attention to my arm now, or maybe I'll do this or I'll do that. So, you know, give things a try. You know, when I'm saying experiment and get creative, you really need to give it, you know, some time. So if you're going to try, say, using the feet with Buddha, you know, maybe try it for the next couple of days. Because it could just be one-off that you do it once and like, wow, that was amazing, like that's my technique. Then all of a sudden you can potentially just get kind of attached to like, this is the way of practice. Or like, oh, that didn't work just because you had like an off day, so then they have to do something else. And then we can get into this habit of just kind of changing, you know, all the time and whatever, rather than like, say, developing like a nice, what's the word I'm looking for? Like an anchor. Because ultimately, like, this is all helping us, all these, say, techniques of walking using the word Buddha or breathing. It's just anchoring the attention, you know, because there is so much going on. We've got these, you know, six doors of experience happening. So just to have that, you know, I think Ajahn was talking about like a boat in the ocean. You just have that anchor that just helps you kind of stay around as you're bobbing around in this ocean of consciousness and whatever, just that little point of reference. So is that helpful?
Why do we practice walking meditation when we have sitting meditation?
Yeah, because we don't live our whole lives just sitting down. You know, our lives involve the four postures. So, you know, mindfulness practice and awareness is, you know, hopefully in the long run becomes part of your everyday life. So, you know, whether you're eating, whether you're about to go to sleep, or you're walking to your car, or you're going to the bathroom, you realize that the opportunity for practice or awareness is always there. It's not like conducive to like only when I'm sitting down can I be awake. You know, many people have their big kind of, when the penny drops, I think for many people it's not when they're sitting meditation, it's when they're just doing something really ordinary, and you just look over and the penny drops and it's, that was that. So, it just helps to incorporate practice into the greater scheme of life rather than just like, you know, a one thing. But, you know, they're all skillful means to, you know, practice.
Why is it that the object of meditation has to be something of the body?
It doesn't have to be.
Okay. What about something external, like, say, a rock or something, you know?
Well, the confusing thing about the body is, like, as long as you're alive, it'll always be with you. You know, if it's a rock or a mollybean, you have to go find it or look for it. The convenient thing about the body is it's always there. You know, like, you can always say the breath. If you're not breathing, you're going to be dead. You know, so... If you have like external objects or something, it's just one extra thing you have to drag around. That's not to say they're not useful. Like, you know, obviously people use kind of things like bells and whistles and beads and these sorts of things. Yeah, there's nothing to say wrong with that. And I'm saying only your body, because there's also the mind. You can use mind, feeling. There's many things that we can put our attention to. But for my little gap of 40 minutes, I just happened to talk about the body. But that's just one possibility.
Thank you.
Venerable, when I meditate, so I hear loud inner sound, and then it helps to relax quickly, and then I'm trying to focus on my breathing, which takes like, let's say, 3 seconds to exhale, 3 seconds to inhale. Along with that, I could feel my heartbeat and blood pumping through the body with every heartbeat. So there's so much going on there, like ringing sound and heartbeat book going on, and with every heartbeat it's like body moves a little, as if, so it becomes it's difficult to concentrate on any one thing. So what to do in situation?
I mean, I get, it doesn't really sound like a problem. Like, again, pointing to that, like, there's an awareness faculty that you have that can notice all these things happening, and you're kind of getting into the thinking about like, oh, like, what should I do? Like, should I watch my breath? Like, what's that? Like, who's that? Who's talking in your head that doesn't know where it needs to put its attention or whatever? But if you said at the beginning of your sentence that you felt quite relaxed by hearing that sound in your ears, I would suggest that that's probably where you should put a majority of your awareness and your attention, because you said the word cooling and calming and relaxed. To be relaxed and open and receptive, that's kind of where you want to be. There's no doing. There's just that, and you've got, say, in your case, you've got that noise. Why not stay there? Then you can notice the heartbeat within that. But okay, like, it's my heart beating, or I can notice breathing. Like, yeah, okay, I'm breathing, but like, okay, I'm just gonna stay with this, because no matter what technique you're doing, things are going to happen. Like, if it's not your heartbeat, it's going to be the sound of a dog barking, or it's going to be a memory of something that happened 10 years ago or yesterday, or something that's happening tomorrow. Something's going to come up. That's just the way our minds do things, and we want to worry about something. So you're almost lucky that the biggest problem you have is do I listen to my heartbeat, or do I, you know, listen to this sound? You know, there's a lot worse things that you could be experiencing, you know, in this moment.
My question is about stream entry. Is it some kind of a deeper flow state or something completely different?
You'll know when you get it. just set the conditions, and it'll do itself.
Namaste, Ajahn.
Namaste.
My question is how to differentiate between the helpful doubt and excessive doubt, which is called vichikitsa. And any skillful question or any skillful technique which you used in your time?
So there's doubt and there's doubt, right? So I guess, as this fellow said, you know, when, how do you, what is the flow state of stream entry or whatever? So one of the things that falls away, which I think Ajahn kind of touched on the first day, we don't have any more doubt. We understand. Intuitive, like we see for ourselves, and we don't have any doubt about the practice. So whatever we read or whatever teachings we hear, like, it just makes sense because we've seen it for ourselves, maybe just momentarily. But we no longer would have doubt that, like, okay, there is a path. I've seen what it's pointing to, and maybe it's dropped away. But that greater doubt kind of drops away. But then we have kind of normal everyday, you know, like as this fellow was asking about the technique or this or that. Should I listen to this? Should I do this? Or I'm not sure if I should be doing Vipassana, or if I should be doing Dzogchen or whatever. This is all just thinking. Doubt is, you know, the main culprit in this hindrance is thinking. We just overthink things. Because if you're not thinking, how can you doubt, right? It's a thinking mind that goes over things, it speculates, it compares, and on and on and on and on. Where, in myself, I was a major doubter for many, many years, and that was, you know, should I do this or should I do that? Should I do this or do that? And again, it's like, you know, you think that the storyline is the important thing, that, like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but, like, there's either this or that. But it was just that habit of just being in that whole speculative, should I do this, should I do that, should I do this, should I do that? And then just kind of seeing it just, like, get cut right through by it. It's all thinking. You know, once you just actually just let go of the thinking, again, you come back to the body, you have a little break from the chitter-chatter within the mind, you know, doubt's no longer there. So, getting over doubt is to see it just as that much as doubt. This is the mind that doesn't know which way it should go. But ultimately, like, life goes on. Like, we think we're in control and we're going to make decisions and whatever, but, you know, it never really works out that way. That overthinking and trying to analyze and whatever really makes a huge difference, because in the long run, that's all it really is thinking.
Ajahn, in the previous meditation that you led us through, you led us inside where we were resting, somewhere inside the body. Some time ago, Ajahn Amaro talked about being anywhere or everywhere, and even when we are going to other places, it's just a state of mind that changes. So are there any creative techniques to access that?
I guess that's what I was trying to do, and the thing is to basically point to it. Like, people, you know, have to find it for yourself. As one of my friends said, awareness is like a joke. You either get it or you don't, you know. So once you kind of get what this is all pointing to, like this awareness and this space and whatever, like, It is where it is wherever you go. So, you know, say flying around the world and doing all this and all that, like, yeah, it's all changing, and you get, you know, to talk about passports and who am I and the identity and all this stuff. But really, it's like it's still just the same. You know, nothing's really changed on that kind of, as far as like awareness is concerned. You know, the contents has all kind of changed, but the context is just there all the time.
And when you asked us to look for the person for that who is aware,
yeah.
And commonly it's supposed to be usually in the head, right? Can it lie outside the body, and are there techniques to access that?
Well, again, I don't know about techniques, but one has to kind of find for themselves. These are all just like pointers. You know, there's no right way, like, okay, I said to do it like this way. Like, that was just what came out of my mouth after having a coffee and then sitting down in front of a microphone. You know, if I did another one right now, it might be different. It's like, okay, like, let's be the birds flying around or whatever. So you kind of have to find out for yourself what it is that helps you stay kind of there in that space, wherever you're perceiving it from. But as I was kind of saying, there is that, it's quite a strong perception that we have that, you know, like right now, like you're looking at me, and I say everyone's kind of like looking up here. You know, if I was going to put my foot out and everyone was like staring at my foot, it'd be a whole different experience. But that's how we live. So I just pulled a muscle doing that. No control. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, one more.
When did you have from Mother City in New Hampshire?
Is it attached to Ajahn Amaru or?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of our branch monasteries. Forestmonastery.org. You can have a look after the retreat. Yeah, it's just another one of our monasteries in the Ajahn Chah tradition. The abbot spent a lot of time with Lumpur Semedo and Ajahn Amaro and Amaravati, so we're it's like our family. Yeah.
Could you repeat that, the URL again? The website?
Forestmonastery.org. TK. Okay, that's it. 10:50.